Rise to Offend, a podcast that explores people who rose to offend in society and their legacy today. I'm your host, Spencer Spych, and this week we are doing part one of two on Ronda Rousey, a female sports star that would change the landscape of physical sports entertainment forever, uprooting a male-driven and masculine sport to a mass appeal and showing marketability and equality in the violent world of mixed martial arts. Born on February 1st, 1987, Ronda would start fighting as soon as she would take her first breath in this world.
It would definitely be benefits from it. I would learn a lot, you know, and I feel like I would gain a lot more confidence from that, you know, knowing that I'd gone the full time. But I don't see any need to go out of my way to go to a decision, you know. Like, you can't ever expect anyone to win a match for you. It's like, if you ever go to a decision, then you've lost.
And joining me this week, Brennan Hahn and Sylvia Alvarado. Born on February 1st, 1987, Ronda Rousey's parents were father Ron Rousey and mother Anne Maria DeMar. Ronda would be the youngest of three daughters, having two older sisters.
She was a single mother working as an engineer, getting her PhD in developmental psychology while she won the world championships in judo. I never really knew that much about my mom being a fighter. It wasn't until she showed me this scrapbook. I just remember looking through it and seeing everything that my mom had done and just being completely blown away.
Before Ronda was born, her mother, Anne Maria, would accomplish many things in her life as an intellectual and an athlete, starting to perform judo at the age of 12 and would win her division at the USJA Junior Nationals at the age of 16.
You know, I was in college at 16. I had left home the year before that. I was in foster care for a while. So really, from about 13 on, I was winging it, you know? People, when their kids are 15, 16, 18 years old, they often think about, well, what would my parents have done? Well, my parents went around. You know, I was living at 17. I was living in Japan as a junior in college. So I pretty much was making it up as I went along. And the same, you know, with coaching Ronda when she was little. So I just tried to figure it out the best I can.
And Maria would attend college at Washington University in St. Louis and her junior year travel to Japan as an exchange student at Waseda University to practice judo while continuing her education. By 1980, Anne Maria would gain her master's degree from the University of Minnesota and be ranked number one in her division in judo.
I think a lot of people try to be their kids, their athletes' friends instead of the parent or the coach. And there's a danger in there, especially when you're coaching, that the kid may quit. They may, if they're very talented, they may go somewhere else. Yes. Where the person, you know, blows a little more smoke up their ass and tells them how great they are. I think if parents are divorced, often they're worried that you'll go live with mom or you'll go live with dad if I, you know, lay down the line too much. And I have to worry about that too much. I mean, you know, when my husband was alive, he obviously had my back. And when he passed away, you know, they were stuck with me.
By 1982, she would relocate to Riverside, California and get her PhD in educational psychology. Temporarily retiring after a storied career in judo and getting her PhD, Anne Maria would come out of retirement in 1984 to participate in the World Judo Championships. And she would be the first person representing the United States to win a World Judo Championship. All these achievements, and including starting a family, were done by the age of 26 years.
My name is Ronda Rousey. I was first a swimmer. I was swimming when I was six, and that was the thing, I mean, my dad did together. You know, I remember my dad, like, scooping me out of bed at, like, 4 a.m. and just throwing me in the car and driving to swim meets. And he always told me, you know, you're going to win the Olympics one day.
How can the achievements and drive of Ronda Rousey's mother influence her as a person?
I think as a kid, you see your parents and you're influenced by them, and you know, you see their passion, you see their drive, and you're like, I want to do that. And I also have a passion in this case, judo and mixed martial arts. So I want to follow in my mom's footsteps. And especially, like, her mom has a lengthy list of achievements. So of course she's going to be, you know, influenced by it.
Of course, living in LA, you're always hearing about people in Hollywood who are in rehab or getting arrested or, you know, people who seem to have it all. And I think one thing that's kept Ronda pretty much on the even keel is nobody in our family takes anything from her. When we go to USC events, we all pay our own way. We buy our own plane tickets. We pay for our own hotel rooms. And we all have jobs. Nobody is making a living off of her. It's not like she bought my house. And so people can tell her to her face if she's screwing up, or, you know, if she's getting a little too in love with herself. And also, she doesn't have to feel like, well, if I screw up, you know, my whole family is going to be out on the street. I told her last night, I said, you know, it's a good movie and all that, but keep in mind, if it all goes away tomorrow, you could live in a townhouse by the beach and design computer games. This is your fallback plan.
And also, let's not forget that her mom probably never let her give up. So anytime Rhonda was like, it's too hard, her mom's like, no.
Because she has that mentality already.
That's it. Yeah, you're never going to be, when you come from a background like that, you're never the victim. You're never the victim. And no matter what kind of situation you're in, you're always taught you can get yourself out. So, you know, when you look at Rhonda's career now, it makes a lot of sense that she had a role model like that.
The first thing I notice is there's only 6 people on this mat. Everybody else, even you, lady with the hurt shoulder, you could be doing something different. Everybody except the guy fighting. You ought to be in here practicing. I had my knee replaced. I had 6 knee operations, several of them while I was competing. When I came back 6 days after surgery to train with stitches in my knee, because I had to do it to win. So you hurt your knee, do push-ups, do some other drill, do something. That's how my mat work got so good. That's how her mat work got so good.
One of my mom's best lines is, she's like, you're not training to be the best in the world. You are training to be the best in the world on your worst day. She would purposely send me to tournaments injured, with no coaches, to like places where she knew the referees and the officiating would be against my favor, and she would purposely do that to me. I used to think she was so heartless, and then one day she was just like, you think every single time that you're injured and crying on the mat, I was sitting there smiling in the corner? No, it hurt me just as much. Pretending that I didn't care was the hard way. That was how I cared, was showing that I didn't. So she gave me what I needed when I needed it, and that's what she's the best at.
Rhonda would be born on February 1st, 1987, and the birth was difficult. She would have the umbilical cord wrapped around her neck while in the womb, and this would restrict oxygen to her. The delivery would leave Rhonda with some brain development issues during that moment where she had no oxygen going to her brain.
The umbilical cord is basically the baby's lifeline. It provides oxygen and nutrients to the baby so the baby can live inside the mom while it's growing. A nuchal cord means that the umbilical cord is wrapped around the baby's neck. When that happens in the labor and delivery process, that can cause serious problems because it can get very tight, especially as the baby's coming down the birth canal. In such a situation, the baby can suffer from lack of oxygen to the brain and birth asphyxia and HIE. So where there's a nuchal cord in the labor and delivery process, and there are abnormalities on the fetal monitor showing the baby's not getting enough oxygen, the baby must be delivered as quickly as possible by cesarean section in order to prevent the baby from suffering from lack of oxygen, birth asphyxia, and HIE, all of which can cause brain damage to the baby.
This problematic birth would cause her to have speech issues early in her development from infant to child, and her father, Ron, would be very protective of her as she grew up and started going to school.
When she was born, we thought she was dead. My husband burst into tears in the delivery room. She wasn't breathing, she was blue, so they brought her back and got her breathing, and then when she was 2, 2 and a half, she still wasn't talking at all. They thought it was due to hypoxia, which is just a fancy name for being deprived of oxygen at birth.
I didn't speak coherently until I was 6 years old, and the only real way I was able to communicate was my sisters translated my gibberish for me. I was frustrated when people wouldn't understand me, and I was trying to get my point across, but I never thought that anything was wrong with me. And my parents never allowed me to feel like I was inferior to anybody else.
Since Rhonda couldn't express herself verbally, she did it physically. The physical things, the athletics, were the things that she could excel in. And so that's what she did every second that she could.
At 3 years old, her family would move to Jamestown, North Dakota, where Rhonda would undergo serious speech therapy, Minot State University.
My mom was very, very worried. My dad was just like, you know what, Ronnie, she's going to be the best of them. She's a sleeper. Just you watch. She's going to show all you guys. And he would tell me all the time, like, you're going to win the Olympics. You're going to be president. My sisters would translate my gibberish. So they're like, what do you want for a bedtime snack, Ronnie? And I'd be like, blah, 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 blah. And my sister would be, oh, she wants chocolate milk and cookies.
Rhonda would have a close bond with her father, Ron. In the early years of her life, she would struggle with speech as she started entering school, and by the age of 6 would notice she was different. But with the highly educated, strong mother role and loving father, Rhonda never felt alone during these times and had a strong foundation.
Her dad was going to retire, and then he got bored. So he ended up getting a job about 130 miles away, and he would come home on the weekends. And then the speech therapist recommended maybe Ronnie could stay with her dad during the week because that would force her to talk.
My favorite memories of my dad are rock hunting. I wanted to be an archaeologist, and he loved off-roading, so we would go hunting for rocks. Another, like, really early memory I have of him, there was, like, this gravel road, and I had, like, this Barbie car, and the car slipped out from under me, and I went face-first into the gravel. And I remember my dad picked me up, and he walked me inside and put me in front of a mirror and made me look at my face. And he was like, look how tough you are, look how tough you are. And I told him I was really tough, and I'm like, but you know, like, what? And then I eventually stopped crying, and he was like, yeah, look at that. You're like, you're the toughest little girl I know. Look at your face. Like, you're so cool.
How important was this structure for a child who had issues with speech and was starting to know she was different than other kids?
I think it's going back to what Brandon was saying, is that because her background, her parents had that, like, you are not going to be a victim. I think that's what made her so strong, especially with kids, because they can be brutal.
She started swimming when she was 6, and she usually was in the top 8 in North Dakota.
My dad would pick me up pretty much when I was still sleeping, put me in the car, drive me there. Swimming was just our thing that we did together.
I think the time that they spent going back and forth to the swimming and going to all the swim meets kind of strengthened the bond between them. When she was in swimming, he would yell so much she could hear him underwater.
I would swim and he would run around along the length of the pool, just jumping up and down, screaming, taking pictures, everything. You know, he was so stoked on it. It was the coolest dad ever.
Kids can be brutal, and when you have a dad that's telling you everything's going to be all right and showering you with love, and you have a mom that's teaching you to be strong, build up some calluses around your soul, whatever kind of terminology you want to use it as, you are going to be able to get through those, because eventually you end up realizing, hey, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And when you grow up with that mentality and then you already have that mental advantage as it is, it could serve as a shield of some sorts.
My mom was the first American to ever win the world championships in judo, and, you know, before any of the men did, you know, and a lot of people told her it wasn't possible for her, and she was a single mother, and she was, you know, getting her PhD, and she was had knee surgeries and all this stuff, and she had every reason on earth for her to believe all the reasons that everyone told her that she wouldn't be able to do it, and she is just an amazing person, and she found a way to make everything that she set her mind to work, so she's very inspiring to me, and I always try to pull from that.
And also, in the early 90s, there wasn't, like, the internet, so when she, whatever issues she had at school, she would come home to a loving environment. She would have her two sisters, she would have her father, she would have her mother, and she would not be, like, the internet, like social media will keep the bullying going.
So when you're leaving school from the bullying, and then you come home to more bullying on social media.
On social media, yeah. She didn't have to deal with that. She had an environment where she can gain confidence. She can gain things like that.
Well, we went sledding one day. I remember seeing him go down the hill and laughing. When he hit the bottom, there was a snowbank, like a log or something that was covered in snow, and he hit it, shooting really fast. It broke his back. They tried putting a metal rod in his back to support his back, and his spine started crumbling away. I remember one day, like, he had mugs. He had a collection of mugs. One day, we grabbed a bunch of them. We were arguing which ones were our favorites, so we went over to him and we were like, Dad, when you die, can I keep this mug? And Jennifer's like, when you die, can I keep this mug? And I remember, like, his face, like, he was just like, he was, like, mad at us, like, he didn't want to talk to us, like, it was something off. And, like, I felt like I was in trouble. I was, like, I felt like, oh, my, like something I said was wrong. I didn't understand why. I've always felt so bad for saying that. Like, that mug. The spine was crumbling away from that rod in his back, and they told him that he only had, like, 2 years to live. First, he would become a paraplegic, and then he'd be a quadriplegic, and then he would die. My dad said that he didn't want
the girl's last memories of him to be in a bed with tubes running in and out of him.
By the time she was 8 years old, in 1985, Rhonda and her sister would go sledding with her father, Ron. And Ron would have a serious accident and break his back. After visiting with a doctor, he would be diagnosed with something called Bernard-Soulier syndrome, which is an extremely rare blood disorder, which would not allow his back to heal, eventually leaving him as a quadriplegic.
Bernard-Soulier syndrome is a rare bleeding disorder. Bernard-Soulier syndrome is caused by deficiency of glycoprotein 1b. Glycoprotein 1b acts as the receptor for von Willebrand factor. Symptoms and signs include easy bruising, nosebleeds, bleeding gums.
At this time, Ron became extremely depressed, and one day while Rhonda and her sisters were inside watching Nickelodeon, Ron would head to the garage and commit suicide by asphyxiation. He was 54 years old.
And so we used to drive out to this pond all the time and go skip rocks and their cattails and push the seeds off and showed me how to push the seeds off and stuff. And one day he went back out to this pond and he put a hose in the exhaust and looped it back in the car. He turned on the car and he just went to sleep. That was it. I never saw my mother cry before, ever. And she looked at me and Jennifer and sat us down and she looked at us and she cried and she said, "Your dad went to heaven." And I didn't even question it for a second. Like, I just remember like I couldn't feel my legs. I tried to go upstairs and I couldn't feel my legs. And now people love to ask me about it all the time because it doesn't make a great story. I feel terrible talking about it. I feel like I'm prostituting his memory to, for my own career gain, and it makes me like a fool.
At the age of 8, Rhonda suffered a huge loss and a person that instilled much confidence and pride in her. What kind of effect can this have to someone at this developmental stage of 8 years old?
I think it'll make you angry. You know, something was just taken away from you, and you can go one way or the other. You can go down a dark, dark path, or you can find some way to get that anger out. And we all end up knowing what she ends up growing up to be. So it kind of makes a lot of sense.
And that's where she took out all her anger. And because of her background, again, it made her stronger. So she decided to not take the victim mentality and go down this, you know, rabbit hole, just darkness. She decided to do something that's going to, you know, help her channel her anger.
When you're a kid, you just think your parents are going to live forever. They didn't know how sick he was. And that's one of the things that they've brought up over the years that, oh, you should have let us know. But Ron said, you know, they're kids. What can they do about it? You know, let them be happy.
That's why I always say I hope he would be proud of me because I don't know.
And understand, like, an 8-year-old's not going to understand what quadriplegia is.
Right.
No, an 8-year-old's never going to come to terms with the reasoning behind this until they're much, much older to be like, oh, I understand maybe why he didn't want to live this life going forward. So at the time, it's going to be almost a form of abandonment, do you guys think?
I believe that. It's like there, I can...
I think at any age, someone's going to feel like that when they, you know, a loved one
it's
commits suicide.
It's unbridled sadness and abandonment and anger. And when you mix those things together, I mean, you can go down a bad path. And I'm not even saying just because we know what she ends up growing up to be, it still wasn't easy for her after that.
I mean, but there is that very, you know, one of the most striking moments in the book is when you talk about your father's suicide. And I mean, was there a part of you that was nervous about just about getting that out there into the public?
I mean, it was known. I guess I didn't delve in it too deeply because the people that I was talking to, the only reason that they would ask me about him was because they would benefit professionally. And I was in a scenario where I would benefit professionally from talking about him. And I was really conflicted about it for a long time to the point where I just stopped talking about him entirely to the media. And I felt like the story did need to be told right and in depth, and
the best way to do it is with my sister.
Nobody in the household, including her mother, saw Ron's suicide coming. And although the depression won in that one moment for Ron, his family and Rhonda would never be the same again. Anne Maria took her family and moved to Santa Monica, California, away from the tragedy, and she would take serious steps in keeping her kids and Rhonda on a positive and confident track.
My mom was the first American to ever win the world championships in judo, and she really made me into who I am today. She really made me a fighter in every sense of the word.
We knew Rhonda was doing well when we would go to things, and it went from her being introduced as Anne Maria's daughter to me being introduced as Rhonda's mom. And you see that, saw that flip come around when she was about, I'd say, 16.
Anne Maria would remove Rhonda from any mainstream schooling and start schooling her full time. And by the age of 11, she would enroll her into judo classes. Rhonda's mother, who had her judo background, would start to train her in judo.
When you're in a sport like judo, you're so immersed in it, and there's this little subculture where everybody that you know and spent your day with, that's the most important in their day too.
Yeah.
And I got outside of that little small group of people and returned to the real world. And I told somebody one day that I was an Olympic medalist, and they said, "Oh, that's cool. I collect stamps." That was a wake-up call for me, because that was, the two were the same to them.
She would discover that she would connect easily with the aggression and the physicality of the sport. She would train with much larger men and get heated when she was not capable of throwing them. She would even accidentally break her mother's wrist during a training session.
People don't realize how bad my body issues were when I was a kid. I wore like baggy clothes every day. There are days I would just like look myself in the mirror and just cry, like looking at myself. It's just stupid the way that, you know, women, and especially in this country, are just conditioned to hate how they look.
What does sports give someone who doesn't have the book smarts when they embrace it as a form of survival?
It's an outlet. There's a certain switch. You see this happen all the time with NFL players. Like, you know, some of these guys are family men and they give back to the community and they're nice to everybody they meet, well-spoken. But the second they get on that field, they are monsters. There's a switch that flips. And this is the same thing, especially when you're in a contact sport. Now you can take out that sadness. Now you can take out that aggression on another person.
The stress from fighting is much, much more. You know, it's like I could get in a random fight. Someone could walk into this room right now and I'll beat the fuck out of anyone in this planet, you know. But it's the training camp and the weeks leading up to it and the press and just like going to sleep every night thinking about it and all those things. Like, that's like the real wear and tear, I feel like, not the physical part of it so much. And of course, like, you know, fights, you just assume, okay, I'm gonna give myself at least a month to recover after that. So it's like, it's a peaking system. You allow yourself to peak and crash. The only thing that compares to the mental strain in MMA is the Olympics.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the one highest, because you train your whole life and you have one day for all of your training and all of your hard work to pay off. It was all for nothing.
Right.
You can get another fight in a couple months. So nothing compares to that.
There's a definitive win or loss. Like, I will beat you, and there's nothing you can do, no matter what. If she can't speak correctly, nothing like that. There's a definitive win or loss, and that kind of solution, there's got to be confidence and power in that, right?
I will say that it took me a while to realize this. Life is about wins and losses, but too many people, they focus on this ultimate win. Mm-hmm. When you look at a lot of things as little wins, tiny wins, then your life gets, you end up having that outlet. You have somewhere to go. It takes you, it puts you in a better frame of mind. Now all of a sudden you're better than some people, especially when you're talking about a contact sport. I just bested someone. Now I feel like I'm better than them. Now I'm higher up on the food chain. I really do think that there's something primal that goes on, especially with contact sports. So when you are filled with that much sadness, anger, aggression, abandonment, whatever negative feeling that you had at that time and probably still does, those little wins, they mean something.
When I was 10 or so, my mom went to go visit her old teammates who opened up schools of their own. And I just went and tried it one day. And, you know, I still had that mindset that my dad gave me. He was like, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it to be the best in the world. I just assumed, okay, if I'm doing judo, I'm going to win the Olympics in judo. 6 years later, I was on my first Olympic team.
And with people that we covered before, like Floyd Mayweather, he had a very rough childhood. And the little wins, despite his outside persona, was what he thinks he should be defined by.
Yes.
That's the only moment in his life is like, you can't take this away from me. And the rest of his life, whether it be his lack of education and stuff like that didn't really matter in his mind, right? Do you think Ronda Rousey has a similar mindset?
I believe,
no, for sure.
Yeah, I believe anybody in any contact sport, that is what defines them. When you look at Floyd Mayweather, you can bring up all these things. Look at all the things that you did, the women that you beat up, and you know the other nefarious acts that you were committing behind the scenes. And all he's got to do is go 50-0, and then it's like, boom, it's a wrap. Okay, argument over.
It's justified.
Yeah.
It's justified, yeah.
I feel like everything happens for a reason, because I never would have started judo if my dad hadn't died and picked up MMA. And this is where life has been steering me since the very beginning. And this is why all these things have happened. So I promised him one day I would be the best in the world in something. And I just really wish that he was here to see it. So all I have to do is win. I need to do that for him.
By the age of 16, Ronda was dominant in judo and would get many accomplishments and start training to attend the Olympics in 2004. She would be enrolled at Santa Monica High School, but would drop out at the age of 16 to focus on her judo career, eventually getting a GED at the age of 17.
The thing is, I don't want everybody to like me, and I don't want everybody to hate me. I want everyone to disagree about me. You know, that's why, like, I look at these forums, and then people are writing novels about everything that I say, and that's what I want. I want every single time that my name comes up in a conversation for it to spark a debate. Not like every time someone comes up like, oh yeah, I like that guy. Conversation over. Like, oh yeah, that guy's a jerk. Oh, conversation over. I want one person to be like, oh, I love her. Oh, I hate her. Yeah. And then I want the conversation to go on like that.
Ronda would be the youngest person to gain a spot on the Olympic judo team and would compete at the 2004 Olympics in Athens. She would not medal in the event, but the loss would be motivating, and she would come back that same year, winning gold at the World Judo Championships in Hungary.
I cried every single practice from like 2002 to 2005, I think. 2006 and a half. I would cry, and they would just keep beating me up, and I would keep going. I would think of it more as like a face leak. You know, I was just involuntary.
I remember at a tournament once, one of my old teammates saying, your daughter's crying. Don't you think she'd talk to her? Because she had lost a match. She was 15 or something, and she'd lost something. She was crying. I said, I'm not going to talk to her. I talked to her every time she cried. That's all I would do every day.
If my mom saw me goofing around or having fun or whatever, she would grab me, and she would pull me and sit me in the corner. She'd be like, shut up and sit down and think about winning. I never went to a single party in high school. You know, I wasn't allowed to have any boyfriends. I wasn't allowed to, you know, it was just train and nothing. I thought my mom was the worst person in the world.
What I wanted to instill in my daughters, that the world is full of people who live lives that are less than they could be because they're afraid. I'm not going to be one of these sucker parents who is paying for you to live in the basement and tell me how you're going to win the Olympics someday, you know, while you party and play Xbox.
Going all in as a teenager in a sport that doesn't have much financial opportunity like female judo, how important was it that Ronda didn't have a plan B and went all in by the age of 17?
I think she just knew exactly what she wanted to do, and she had, you know, the ability to do it, because that is one hell of a, you know, your
risk.
Yeah, exactly. You're gambling with your future, and if you don't have a plan B, she has to have so much confidence in her abilities.
If you didn't go to the Olympics, where would Ronda Rousey be now?
I would be a rescue swimmer for the Coast Guard. I'd be jumping out of helicopters and saving drowning people in boats. No desks.
Cool.
No desk for me. You know, Olympians they got tunnel vision put on. You know, they know how to do it. It's just no one ever talks to them on how to deal with what to do afterward. You know, you don't even put any thought into your life afterward. And I think that's what people need to talk about the most is, okay, yes, you're an Olympic medalist now. What?
You can't turn pro.
Education after the Olympics. Maybe you should have a thing.
They should have some sort of like, they should have some sort of scholarship program or something for Olympians after they're done competing, or some sort of work program, not just a handshake and a couple of grand that we're going to tax you on later this year. I mean, you know, I can't believe how Olympians are treated in this country. And everyone's like, ooh, la, la, Olympics, America's so good.
Well, I also believe, too, having a mom who was also a world champion, mm-hmm. who also knows talent when she sees it, going, you are better than the rest. So keep pursuing this. But I never have been a big believer in somebody who just goes for it, because when you do go for it, you don't realize what you're doing to everyone around you. Now, granted, she had her mom as a support system. I'm sure that was a big, major factor in this decision. But in regular cases, in most cases, I'd never advise somebody just drop everything and go for it.
And not have a plan B.
And not have a plan B, especially when it comes to being an athlete, because so many things can go wrong when you're an athlete. Maybe you break your wrist. Maybe you tear your ACL.
And your career, done.
And, you know, and this is judo, too. It's not boxing. They're not making $65 million a fight. You know what I mean? They're probably getting a $10,000 grand prize that's going to last until the next fight or the next year.
If you win an Olympic gold in 2012 from Armenia, you get $700,000.
Really?
Just from, Tsarukyan, his name is. He's the Olympic Committee
president. How much you get in America to win?
And then you get few million thing, which is American money. It's like maybe another like 150 to 200,000. So you'll get like 900,000. The country pays you like 150, and then he pays you 700, so like 850.
If you're American, you get a gold medal, you have $25,000, silver is $15,000, $10,000.
But you get taxed on that later, so half of it is
gold. Oh, but that $800,000 in Armenia is like having like $10 million in America.
Yeah, and you got to realize that I don't think any of this plan B that we're talking about mattered to her. It was just the moment.
Well, and
don't
she
you think
was 16.
Maybe 17 at this point.
Okay,
correct.
But still, she was still young enough to not really know any better.
Exactly. Yeah. At 17 years old, you think you know everything, and then the older you get, you end up realizing just how stupid you were at that age. I'm sure if you ask Ronda Rousey now what she was thinking at 17, she'd probably be like, I didn't know any better. But thank God she stayed on that path, or else she wouldn't have the success that she's enjoying today.
But also, if you ask Ronda Rousey now, she would say, this is the best decision I ever made.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Fighting in the Blind Monk Urban Pub Blue Corner. She weighed in at 149 pounds, fighting out of Glendale Fight Club and Hayston MMA in Santa Monica, California. Please welcome Hard Knocks fighter, Ronda Rousey.
Going all in to something like a sport, there's a certain quality to these athletes. Kobe Bryant, Ronda Rousey, Floyd Mayweather Jr. That's like almost sociopathic, that there is a single focus of like just this rage that you will never, ever contain me until I reach what I want to reach. There's something real special about them inside that probably is clinically not healthy if they took it aggressively to other people
or in other aspects of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think when you have a drive like that, a drive that focused, and especially when it's a drive to, I got to beat the shit out of that person. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want that spilling over to other aspects of your life.
There are a lot of people that think that women didn't belong in MMA. They didn't belong in the gym. There are a lot of people that thought that I would never be successful. And proving all those people wrong is what really kept me going. I just had so much energy. I didn't have a second to rest. I would shadow box in the shower just to like, I felt like I was trying to make as much progress as possible at every point. I was obsessed. I was dating this one guy at the time where we started going out while I was bartending, and then we stopped going out while I was fighting.
By the age of 19, she would return to the Olympics, this time in Beijing, and gain a bronze medal. And by the age of 21, she would see that the future she needed to survive would need a different direction, and she would retire from judo at this age and start to focus on mixed martial arts.
Well, I would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I would go running at negative 20 degrees below zero. And I would have to pretty much devote my whole day, every single day, to training. And I would go train in the evenings, and I was like a little girl compared to everybody else because there's a big age gap. Mm-hmm. Like the closest people to my age are like 30. So I was like, I was very lonely. But my only outlet, my only solace was actually competing and fighting. And so it was a strange time. I felt like I was on this grand mission, you know. I was at Miyagi's house and he was just not really babying me. I was at a time where I felt like I had to endure hardship in order to deserve greatness.
By 2011, she would join the GFC, Glendale Fighting Club, and try to transition to a long-term career in mixed martial arts. At the time in 2011, female MMA was similar to that of female boxing and other female sports like the WNBA, and no athletes crossed over truly into any mainstream format.
I kind of slowly lost my love of the sport. I love
of judo.
I love the art, but the sport was taking away from my enjoyment, and so I was so unhappy, and I couldn't really figure it out. I thought maybe it's because I did miss out on all these things. Maybe that's why it seems like whenever I watch TV or whenever I see a music video and every single time I hear a song about popping bottles in the club, everyone sounds so happy and I'm not. So I'm like, maybe that's what I'm missing.
Yeah.
Because I never went to a single dance party, had a date in high school.
Yeah.
So I'm like, maybe I'm missing out. Maybe that's what it is. And I went to go see if that's what it was, and it wasn't. And that whole year was important because that's how I really discovered my path was leading me to MMA. And it wasn't being a bartender and getting drunk every day, so I wouldn't think about how unhappy I was.
In 2011, was there truly any blueprint for a female athlete to enter the mainstream? And why do you think there wasn't?
I just think that at the time, it was a male-dominated sport. And let's face it, when you think violence, you don't think women. You think dudes. So she's got that working against her. But with everything, there's got to be a game changer.
And then when I quit judo, her old teammate Gokor, who also, they all went to Tenri Judo in Los Angeles, who I would go to Gokor's club all the time and train when I was doing judo, but he was the only person I knew doing MMA, and I didn't want to train with anyone I didn't know or trust, you know, to really have my best interest at heart. And so I started training with him, and it's been going great. I'm pretty happy about how things are going.
Look for Ronda Rousey to keep her career going in an upward direction, and safe to say you'll be a future champion of sport.
I hope so. I'm going to find a way to make it so.
Now, but a lot of women athletes, even in the WNBA or anything, would not get any sort of attention, monetary value for these games, these athletes, everything like that. Nothing was on even like an iota of a scale in 2011. And the WNBA was
Serena
probably,
Williams.
Okay, I'm sorry. Tennis is different. You're right. Tennis and soccer could be different. I guess I'm talking about more the...
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, when you're talking about a contact sport, when women started getting into contact sports, you were just like, wait a minute, what?
I guess this boxing doesn't make it. Yeah.
People forget that, you know, women doing sports, women playing contact sports, that's still relatively new in society in general. Yeah. You know what I mean? But I'm just saying it's still relatively new to society in general.
Because again, like you said, when you think violence, you don't think of women because
right.
we're much more quote unquote dainty.
But that's what I'm saying. Like throughout the centuries, this is how women have been depicted. They've been depicted this way in religious texts. They've been depicted
oh, for sure.
this way, and it's Shakespeare all the way down. And then now all of a sudden you see these women getting in the ring and performing these, some of these fights were vicious acts of violence.
And can probably kick your ass.
And probably could kick my ass, you know? But I mean, it's just like, you know, but seeing that though.
It's surprising, yeah.
It's surprising. Mm-hmm. It catches you off guard.
And another throw. And trying to lock an arm in as she has the headlock lock. Trying to get that left arm free was Ronda Rousey. Instead, she's going to transition to a half card position and try and do some damage there. She thought for a second of trapping an arm and instead gets herself to the mount and now looks for an arm bar. And she's got it! Ronda Rousey in quick fashion finishes this fight with an arm bar. Goodness
wow.
gracious!
What a performance from Ronda Rousey as she gets in there and gets the job done with an armbar submission, and she moves to 2-0 as a professional.
Is there a loss of femininity?
Yes.
I think in that moment.
In that moment.
In that moment, yes, because outside of the ring, they could wear their dresses, they can wear their makeup, or they can do their hair, whatever.
And they do.
And they do, and they look gorgeous, the same.
And that's the fun. That's the thing about some of these UFC fighters. I mean, some of these women are gorgeous, and
yes.
you know, and they get in there, but they do. They remind me of Oscar De La Hoya, who was like one of the prettiest boxers ever.
Mm-hmm.
But when he got into the ring, that's what I'm saying. Because
the way she said it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember Oscar De La Hoya.
But it's funny because, like, you know, whenever you see Oscar De La Hoya at a press conference or on a television show, he's got that big smile, his pearly whites. But when he got in the ring, there was a demeanor to Oscar De La Hoya, where winning was the only thing that mattered. Mm-hmm. The switch flipped. And when you would see that, and especially female mixed martial arts, again, at that time, it was surprising.
It's not uncommon, especially where we're in a society that has kind of unhealthy and unrealistic beauty standards given to young girls. But on top of that, I was also in a sport that had weight divisions, and I had to be certain weights on deadlines. And those two things combined were very bad for me at that age. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people that were training me at the time had no experience training teenage girls and didn't know that there are certain things that you have to handle differently with a young girl going through puberty and, you know, being self-conscious about everything. And like, you know, it's crazy how little kids, their self-esteem drops at that age. You know, you're a young kid and you think, I'm the ultimate warrior. I'm awesome. Da da da. And then we get to your formative years, your teenage years, and you just start to doubt everything about yourself. And it was all those factors at the same time that came together.
They take away the makeup. They're not, their hair isn't done, but what they want to take away from the fact that, hey, these women are more than just, you know, pretty faces.
Yeah.
They're more than pretty bodies. They have talent and they can kick your ass.
And any time that is pointed out, men get threatened.
Yes. The insecurity of that is that men are going to be like, there are no pretty girls that can do that. So you're losing your prettiness as a female at a young age. She's obviously at this point very young, 22, 23 right. years old. Mm-hmm. And men are going to be like, you can't do this and be seen as attractive. Mm-hmm. You're going to be seen as somebody that's muscular.
That's
somebody
violent. That's violent.
And that's an insecurity that she had to fight against that and I think a lot of people don't realize.
And on top of that, too, like, you know, when you do speak to women, and especially when you live here in Las Vegas, mm-hmm. I mean, you're reminded on every billboard that this is how you have to look. You have to look this pretty. You have to be this attractive. You have to hold up this image. And when you're doing just the opposite, I mean, again, you're going to catch people off guard. They're not going to know how to take it. Mm-hmm. Some people might react negatively to it.
You know, I thought so little of myself for so long.
Yeah.
And I worked so hard to think that I was worth something.
Yeah.
That I don't understand why people are so offended that I have the confidence that I worked for years toward. And I think that a lot of people confuse humility with self-depreciation. Why do I have to think less of myself to be a better person? I think that complimenting yourself is the funnest form of manifestation. If I look myself in the mirror and I go, you look good, gorgeous, yeah. I feel more pretty the rest of the day. Does it make me a better person if I look myself in the mirror and I shrug and walk away and I'm just a little bit less jazzed that morning? I mean, that I think that I like to show my humility in different ways than most people do. And a lot of people call that arrogance, but I just call that being myself.
Rousey would train at many different leading academies for MMA, including BJ Penn School and that of the Gracie family. But her mother's advice would stick with her the most, which was the following. I've always argued the best defense is a good offense. If you are attacking your opponent, half of their attention has to be spent on defending your attacks. So they are going to be much less effective in attacking you. Whether as a coach or competitor, it's best to keep this in mind. You don't fight principles, you fight people. I had a serious injury when I was young. I have since had a total knee replacement, an option that did not exist back then because of that disability. My standing technique was very limited and was necessary for me to take the opponent to the ground as soon as possible before my knee gave out on me and I fell. Standing around waiting to defend an attack was not an option for me.
We ended up rushing off to, you know, somewhere to get stitched up. It was 9 stitches, and they just pumped me full of antibiotics and said, you know, you shouldn't fight. And then so I decided to fight instead. But I had to find a way to hide it. So when we got to the weigh-ins, I was like, all right, I'll weigh in with socks on. And then, you know, I'm going to put this little, like, ankle thing, like, upside down so it covers my whole foot. We get to weigh-ins, they say I can't weigh in with socks. So, and the girl was 4 pounds over. So I told him, like, oh, I think I drank too much. I'm getting really paranoid. I think I should weigh in naked. So then I weighed in naked, and then the athletic commission people, like, looked away, and they just looked at the scales. And then I got in with a cut on my foot. And then, what's it called? Then I fought, and put the sleeve thing on my foot because they said we couldn't have any tape on the foot at all. So I put the sleeve thing on, and they said I would probably rip the stitches open and bleed everywhere within a round. So I was going to just try and finish as fast as possible, and in 25 seconds I was done. And then limped for the next 3 days.
This advice would be vital for her undefeated start, as she would attack opponents immediately with a patent armbar, and they would lose before they could even react. After a quick 3-0 MMA record using this technique, she would debut her professional MMA career at the King of the Cage on March of 2011, and again would win by a quick rush and armbar approach. Rousey was stronger than her opponents, and this method would be almost impossible to counter because of her strength.
Talk about, you know, how it has been for you and the exposure and what your goals are in mixed martial arts.
Well, my goal is I want to be, you know, undisputed pound for pound, the best woman in the world in mixed martial arts. And there's a lot of people that are skeptical of that. But, you know, I've made history before, and I'm not, you know, this isn't the most insane thing I've tried to do.
Why do you think the rush and armbar approach in female MMA was such an unstoppable device for Rousey when it's something that people can counteract in male MMA?
Because, again, you were just bringing up the strength. I mean, women aren't necessarily used to that. They're, I mean, usually when you would watch a lot of the female mixed martial arts, they would just rush at each other and start swinging and throw some kicks, you know, because a lot of them came from kickboxing backgrounds. Well, this is the first chick that I remember when if Ronda got you on the ground, it was a wrap. It was a wrap. So, like, I remember watching her a couple of times, and I'm like, they got to see this coming. And then fight over. You know, it was
25 seconds.
Yeah, 25 seconds. And it was like, and you would see, like, she would, the girls were like, all right, I know she's going to come for the arm. And then Ronda would get a hold of the wrist, get her to the ground, arm bar, wrap, you know, tap, tap, tap. It's game over.
Well, striking is one of my favorite things, actually. People say I suck so horrible at it. I actually really like to do it. I got tired of doing judo because I was just doing the same things over and over, and you get to a point where you're not learning new things, you're just learning how to do things you already know better, you know, and so striking was something, you know, it's an entirely shiny new toy for me, so I love coming and doing this stuff, and you know what, like, I've only really been training seriously in striking since, like, August or so, and, you know, people are being pretty critical of me, but, you know, just give me some time, okay? Like, I just started, and I'll catch up, and, you know, they're not worried about me. I think people are, like, kind of more rooting against me, but if they want to see me lose, they still want to see me, so I'm still stoked.
I just think that, especially in that league, I don't think the other women were used to people coming at them with that much rage.
Because there wasn't, and if you ever watched female boxing, the knockout ratio is very small. There isn't a one-punch-powered knockout artist in female MMA or female boxing. Very rarely do you see someone with that kind of power. In male MMA, if you rush somebody and they catch you, you're out.
It's out.
You got 250-pound guys throwing all their weight at you. You can't do that. And in 145, where she started, or 135, where she did a lot of her career in, there wasn't that power. So she figured out a way to be like, look, you can't knock me out before I grab you.
It was just, you know, like Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson would run. He would come in there with his arms blocked. He'd go. They would punch. He'd walk right through their punch, and they'd just catch him with a serious, vicious uppercut. And that was his style. And it's funny because when you watch old videos of Mike Tyson, you're like, how is this happening? How is this happening? But again, he was physically superior than his opponents.
And that was the same with Ronda Rousey.
Yes.
And she was always like, you can't knock me out. Nobody can knock me out. I'm going to run at you and do what I want with you. And then you're going to have to break, or I'm going to pop your fucking elbow out of your socket. This kind of confidence and mentality was not seen. And like I said, it was a kind of a one-step approach. And you never saw
kind of a one-step approach.
It was a complete one-step approach.
That's what it was.
That's the thing, is that I guess you can say that there wasn't a plan B in her own attack early on in her career, because it kept working.
Yeah.
Do you guys agree with that?
Well, dude, if it keeps working, what's the point of changing it?
If it ain't broke, why fix it?
Obviously, knowing that the UFC has been anti-women's MMA, does that worry you a little bit for the future of women's MMA?
Well, it is a little troubling that things could, you know, it could be like kind of dissolved, but I really don't think it will. And I'm trying as much as I can under my own power to kind of bring some more attention to MMA, you know, to women's MMA. So we'll see. Hopefully I can get some more people rooting for me and, you know, try and bring us back into kind of the limelight. You know, I think a fight between me and Gina would get a lot of attention. You know, I just like to build up, get some more publicity and turn that into a huge fight. Because if you've seen like the fight between her and Cyborg, the place is going insane. You know, people were talking about it still, and that was a long time ago, and I would like to generate another fight like that. That's my next major goal.
I think sometimes in a lot of athletes, and you've seen this happen in the MMA, there was a fighter named Chuck Liddell, and Chuck Liddell would throw these haymakers and he would hit people, and it was surprising how hard he would hit these people, and their eyes would just roll on the back of their head. I mean, they would be out. Well, he got caught. And I mean, the second he got caught, the knockouts for him started becoming more and more vicious. And it's because all of a sudden, when before he would just go in there like a whirlwind and just take him out, well, now all of a sudden he knows after he gets knocked out a couple of times, he's got that in the back of his head. He knows he's not invincible. And the second that gets taken away from you, something changes.
Well, it's hard to come up like in an appropriate way, because if you already have like a background where, you know, say I have an Olympic background or whatever like that, like I'm not going to be able to fight, you know, the lowest level people and slowly come up, because no one will want to take the fight. Everyone wants to protect the record. If they don't think that they, you know, can win a match, they won't take it, which is really frustrating, because when I was in judo, you know, I show up at the tournament and you're like, oh crap, this is my draw, but that was your draw and you fought the people that you had.
But let's talk about that. That's a perfect example. In MMA, if you have a stick, even in boxing, like when we talked about Mike Tyson, if you have a shtick that works and you have a confidence, it's like, hey, I can keep doing this until it's broken, you don't have to fix it, as Sylvia was saying. But in actuality, does that mean that you are one of the top tier person, or you just mastered one art form?
I think what ends up happening, I just think that once you end up losing and once you end up realizing that you're not invincible, And this only happens when you get knocked out. Mm-hmm. It's one thing when you're in an MMA fight and then, you know, you get on somebody and then one wrong move, all of a sudden they got your ankle, they got your hand, you're tapping. That's a different animal. When you get knocked out, your whole game plan is over. Everything that you've relied on is over, and you never want that to happen again. I can only imagine what it would be like watching tapes. I watched a 30 for 30 with Chuck Liddell on it, and he's watching his last fight at, you know, age 48 years old. He gets knocked out, and he's watching the tape after the fight, and you just see the look. And as soon as he gets knocked out, he just looks to the side, and you just see the disappointment written all over his face, because he knows, if I just had my hand up, all I had to do was just keep my hand up when I'm throwing. I practice this all the time, but I drop my guard, boom, it's a wrap. And that's basically what it is. Once you lose that feeling of invincibility, your whole game plan is over, and then you have to rely on a completely different tactic. And if you're not able to switch and be good with the switch, all of a sudden you're a one-trick pony, and now you're not headlining anymore. You're not the champion anymore. You're never going to be the champion anymore.
All right, so you make your pro debut March 27, 2011, and here we are less than 2 years later, and you are the consensus pound-for-pound number one female fighter in the world and the face of women's MMA. Are you surprised it's all happened so quickly?
I'm not surprised in that, like, I expected that out of myself. I was trying so hard at the beginning. It was like every single time after a fight, I was like, give me another one. Now. Like, I just felt like I had to get it all done so quickly that I'm just kind of surprised that more things didn't go wrong, you know? Like, if I wrote this out from the very beginning, I was like, okay, I want to start at this point. I want to fight for title this time, and I want everything to go this way. I think things are going better than I actually planned. And I'm kind of getting suspicious, like something should go wrong pretty soon because it's too cool, I think.
Do you feel that's every sport, though? Steph Curry and the three for the Golden State Warriors. Like, do you feel it's every sport that the majority of the athletes have something they've mastered that you can't stop and they just keep going with it?
No, I don't think that's the majority of the sport. I think the greats get better as they go. Steph Curry is also an amazing ball handler, and he's also an amazing hustler that gets his players open by setting picks. There's other things that he does that makes him a superstar. LeBron James didn't have the three-point shooting percentage that he has now. He got better at his game. Michael Jordan, the big knock in the 80s was he doesn't have a jump shot.
But in physical sports.
You mean like hand-to-hand combat?
Hand-to-hand combat.
I think once
Floyd Mayweather's a great defender.
But
Ronda Rousey has this Russian armbar.
But Floyd Mayweather started off as a knockout artist. And then when he went up in weight, now all of a sudden he realized that. He realized what his strengths were. What are my strengths? I am faster, and I'm a much better defender than any of these guys. I might not be able to knock these guys out that are walking around at 20, 30 pounds heavier than my regular walking around weight is. But I'll tell you what, they're going to miss, and I'm going to pop them 6-7 times in the face. And that's going to go all to the points.
That was just kind of like the beginning of the next part of the whole journey where I just felt like, okay, got this.
Fighting out of the red corner, weighing in at 146 pounds, she specializes in judo.
Ronda Rousey closes the distance on Julia Budd.
Oh my goodness.
This is unbelievable. Julia, she catches here.
Holy cow, that's dislocated.
It's unbelievable. Ronda Rousey does it again.
She doesn't give a damn. She busted a couple gals' arms. C'est la vie. Let's move on. Where are we eating tonight?
I don't know if I've ever seen anything like it. Four wins, four arm bars, four first round finishes.
It was hard to ignore Ronda Rousey. She made me start to think, all right, I'm interested in women's MMA.
She is the armbar queen. Rowdy Ronda Rousey makes it four straight wins to kick off her professional mixed martial arts career.
I was on some interview phone call. I remember, like, my phone like had a call waiting on there, and I had some number from Vegas, so I was about to say, who the f*** do I know from Vegas? Because usually that's how I answer an unknown call, like, who the f*** do I know from Arizona? But I didn't that time. And so I picked it up, he's like, it's Dana White, and I went, ah!
By July of 2011, Ronda Rousey would get her chance on the Showtime brand of MMA called Strikeforce, and this would be the major exposure she and female mixed martial arts would need to enter the future of this sport.
When are we going to see women in the UFC, man?
Never.
I remember the day Dana White was recorded saying that women's MMA was never going to happen in the UFC. And a few days after, I was talking to her, and she's like, I know he's going to love me. I know he's going to love me. I just have to convince him, you know?
I'm going to get you. Whether or not, I'm going to get you.
I just feel like, if I wanted women's MMA in the UFC, I want it badly enough where I didn't trust anybody else to do it for me. So I just made it a personal goal for mine and went for it. While everyone was playing Miss America and trying to be super, like, politically correct all the time, I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna be a ballsy-ass mouthy bitch.
Follow my co-host, Brandon Hahn, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Mr. Hahn Comedy. Jocelyn Sharp on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Jocelyn Sharp. And Sylvia Alvarado on Twitter and Instagram, at It's the Sylvia. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, at Rise to Offend, and on Instagram, at Rise to Offend Official. And make sure to listen to us every Monday on the Metal Sucks podcast on MetalSucks.net. Email us comments, questions, errors we may have made, or any figure you would like us to cover, risetooffend@gmail.com. Discover the life and work of Ronda Rousey by reading her autobiography, My Fight, Your Fight, available wherever books and audiobooks are sold. Watch her fights and career via UFC and the WWE and support all her acting projects. All content on this show is copyrighted by its owners. Thank you all so much for the reviews on iTunes. These 5-star reviews are helping the show grow and is all we can ask from you guys. Please, if you listen to the show and appreciate all the hard effort behind it, review the show on iTunes for us. It truly means the world that you take the time to listen and to review the show. Next week, we will do part 2 of 2 on Ronda Rousey. Until next week, repeat offenders. RTO Podcast, signing off.